Peter. Welcome on Global Conversations. And it's lovely to have an award-winning, world-renowned psychologist with us today. And of course, we'll be talking about your life and your book, If I Were You, A Psychologist on a Couch. Like, obviously, what made you to write that book? But before we talk about your book, I would like to know, how did you get into psychology? Were you, I believe I read you wanted to be an actor, but then you turned into psychology, because even I've done psychology, I'm like a degree, I have a degree in psychology, but here I am as a filmmaker. So I think we kind of switch careers midway. So how did
yes.
that happen with you?
Well, I was very good at drama at school. And I think I realized when I reflected on my life that being good at drama was a very good coping mechanism for me. But I was very good at it. And my fantasy was to go to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London and be a Shakespearean actor. Okay. And my mother, God rest her soul, said to me, look, you know, that's not a bad idea, but maybe you should go to university first and get a degree so that you've got something to fall back on, because the life of an actor is a very tenuous one at best. And you know what? She was absolutely right. The funny thing is, so I went to university and I ended up becoming a psychologist. Many years later, in the 90s, I used to appear on a TV show called Good Morning Australia, which was a live national show, obviously in the morning. Yeah. And I was the resident psychologist on the show. So I had a spot each week. And Mary, I used to sit there in the studio with my makeup on under the full lights with the floor manager going 5, 4, 3. And I used to think, hey, I'm sort of an actor still, except I'm playing this role of this guy called Peter Quarry, who's a psychologist. So I really do believe if you have a particular passion, you find a way of expressing it, even if it's a little different to what you originally had in mind.
Coming back to the book, If I Were You, what gave you the inspiration of writing that? Because, you know, normally psychologists, they like to listen to they have patients the whole day, and I'm wondering, if you are a psychologist, has it ever been with you, like you're listening to someone, but then you are in your own world, your mind is wandering somewhere else, and the person in front of you is actually telling their woes or their despair, and you're actually in some other world of your own, and then you come back and you're like, yeah, okay. Does it happen?
Well, you asked two questions. I'll answer the second one first. Okay. And the answer is, of course, your mind wanders. You know, you try and stay focused on your client, but you know, we're human as well, so of course the mind wanders a little bit from time to time. But to go back to your first question, Mary, which is, why did I write the book? Well, I've had a wonderfully successful career as a psychologist. The main thing that I did, I mean, I did a number of things, but the main thing that I did is I had a company called Ash Quarry Productions, which produced corporate training videos on topics like leadership and working in teams and how to be motivated and all of those sort of soft skills. And in fact, we used to distribute our programs in India. I know that for a fact. And I did that for about 30 years. When I hit my early 60s, I thought, okay, what do I want to do now? And I'd been doing some reading about getting older, and I came across the work of an American psychologist called Victoria Howard, and she talked about the benefit of doing what's called a life review, which is where you sort of step back from your life and you have a look at it, you kind of analyze it. And I thought to myself, gee, that sounds like an interesting thing to do. I'm going to do that for myself. Now, I promise you, I had no intention of writing a book at the time. This was purely a kind of an exercise that I wanted to do for myself. And about 3/4 of the way through, when I looked at what I produced, I thought, no, I want to share this with people, because I really do believe that this can help people make peace with the past, get to know themselves better, and also plan for a better future. And the book's been out for about a month now, and I'm really thrilled with the reaction it's getting.
Why is life review so important for people? Like, why would you recommend it? Like, how did it help you in reviewing your life, especially coming in terms with your sexual identity, coming out, your childhood, coming in peace with your childhood? Maybe I've read that you have written dedicated a chapter towards your dad passing away. So how did that affect? How does all that affect in anyone's life?
Yeah. Well, when you do a life review, what you do is you write out the story of your life. And we know from research that when you write about your past, particularly when you write about difficult things that have happened, maybe traumas, in my case, for example, my father dying when I was very young, you know, discovering that I was gay. I can assure you it was not cool to be gay. We know from research that writing out the story of your life can actually achieve benefits. You can actually lessen symptoms like anxiety or depression or what have you. But the other side of the coin of doing a life review is not just writing about what happened. The other thing is to analyze it, to unpack it, to try and make sense of it. And we know once again from research, psychological research, that when you unpack your life, when you sort of start connecting the dots, when you start seeing the patterns, when you start understanding yourself more, that this can have the best effects. So, for example, one of the things that I realized, I mean, one of the many realizations that I had doing this exercise for me was that I'm actually a pessimist. And I'd always thought that I was an optimist. And it amazed me when I looked at the pattern and I thought, no, I'm actually a pessimist. And all of a sudden, a whole lot of things made sense to me. And I connected a whole bunch of dots. For example, in the share market, I invest money in the share market, and I'm always terribly, terribly, terribly cautious. And I realize now that that is an expression of my pessimism, because I'm always expecting there to be a crash. Mm-hmm. And guess what? There hasn't been one yet. Mm-hmm. So I think you can, as I said before, you can make peace with your past. You can understand yourself better, but most importantly, you can still make plans for your future.
Right. So what is the most difficult thing as a psychologist? Like when you're with a client, does it trigger your own past when you're listening to some of their problems? Like, does it happen?
Yeah. Well, of course. And I mean, I trained as a psychologist back in the 1970s. And one of the things that we were very, very keen on then in the training was to develop self-awareness, because you as a psychologist need to realize what you bring to the table. What are your hot buttons? What are your issues? And some, because it might get in the way of the work that you're doing with a client. And so you have to know yourself. Now, it was Socrates, of course, who famously said, "The unexamined life is not worth living." And I agree with him. And so examining your life by doing a life review, you can kind of get to know yourself better. And there's a lot of research. I mean, I quote research all the time, Mary, but I think it's important to be evidence-based. There is a lot of research that people who have a high level of self-awareness, who know themselves, who understand themselves, who know what their hot buttons are, they tend to be better students, they tend to be better parents, they are more effective as bosses, they lead more profitable companies, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Socrates was right. Spending some time looking at yourself, doing a life review, actually leads to all sorts of incredible benefits in your life. I mean, I think it's a good thing to do.
I would like to ask here, like, what advice or tip would you give to a psychologist or maybe therapist, counselors, to not get emotionally involved with the clients? Because sometimes it does happen, you kind of have sympathy and you kind of try to look through their shoes, or maybe, you know, look at your life through their view. So how not to get involved there?
Well, I'm going to answer your question, but not exactly your question, because anyone who's a psychologist should know how to do this already. Right. What I'm going to do instead is pretend that you asked me a slightly different question, which is, what should a non-psychologist do? Like a friend, a family member, someone, because I think they haven't had that training and don't know how to do this. Yeah. And I think it's very, it can be dangerous both for you and for the other person if you get too involved. And this is all about managing boundaries. It's all about knowing when to stop. I mean, I guess the classic example, and we all have been there, is we have a needy friend. who, right, you know, a needy friend who's got all these problems and they want to phone up and they want to talk about it. And every time you meet them for a coffee, they're talking about it. And so you're trying to be a good friend and you're trying to be supportive and you're trying to be, at what point do you actually end up getting manipulated and exploited? And so there comes a time, say in a friendship, where you've actually got to say, look, you know what, I'm totally in sympathy with your issues, but I really don't want to spend the whole time talking about it. I'd like to talk about some other things. I'd like to tell you a little bit about what's happening in my life, for example. So I think the challenge is more for friends and family members dealing with, you know, people with problems rather than psychologists. Psychologists should know how to do it by now.
So as a writer, what advice would you give to people who are there to write books? Maybe some a different insight as a psychologist in, you know, writing a book or coming out or publishing.
Yeah, well, look, this is my first book. So, you know, I don't know that I'm full of advice. If I'd written 20 books, probably a different story. Mary, one of the things, as I mentioned before, I very deliberately decided to not publish this as a book when I started. And I think that was a very good thing because it took the pressure off me to have to do, you know, to think about the audience and are they going to like it and is the book going to sell and all these sort of things. I just did it as an exercise for me. So I think that would be one tip that I would give, you know, just write for yourself. In fact, I think someone once said that the first draft of a book you write for yourself and the second draft you do for other people. I think I've got that right. Yeah. One thing that I did with my book, now this is peculiar to my book, is that I broke it up into a number of letters. It's actually in the form, in a series of letters that I write to myself. So Pete, kind of the wild young crazy person, writes to PQ, who's the psychologist, and says, can you help me doing a life review? And then PQ answers, well, why do you want to do it, and so on. Now, breaking it down into those letters was a really good way, because when you think about writer's block, you know, writer's block is a form of procrastination. You know, oh, it's too hard, I don't want to do this. Now, we know that one of the best ways of overcoming procrastination is to slice a big, horrible, overwhelming task, to slice it into a number of little pieces and then do one piece at a time. So for me, by writing letters backwards and forwards, these were my slices. And this meant that at any one time I'd say, I'm just going to write one letter. And then if I don't want to go anymore, I don't need to do any more. So that's a good procrastination tool. In terms of getting it published, look, it's really hard. And I don't want to pretend, you know, it's really hard. I decided not to go down the self-publishing route. I wanted to get a publisher. So what I did is I got myself a literary agent and I had to pay him. And he went around and pitched it to all the publishers. And finally we got one and I published it with Hardy Grant here in Australia. That's of course involves expense, which not everyone can do, but you know, self-publishing, you have to be very lucky to get anywhere with self-publishing. I mean, I don't want to be negative, but that's the simple reality.
Right. That is very true. Like writing a book is easy, but promoting it and publishing it is very hard.
Look, I learned a lesson when I had my video production business, and that is however much time, energy, and money you spend producing a product, whatever it is, whether it's a book, a video, or a whatever, you have to spend the same amount of time, energy and money in marketing it, because you've got to let the customers know that it's there. If they don't know that it's there, they're not going to buy it. And that is a really hard, people seem to think that if they're going to write the book, magically it's going to sell. It doesn't work like that. No. So be prepared to do the marketing and, you know, promotion, and it can be very tedious. I mean, I'm lucky I'm talking to people like you, which is a total pleasure, but you know, pushing and doing all of that can be hard. But I don't want to discourage people. But that's why, just do it for yourself. Don't worry about the publishing and the marketing. Just write it for yourself and let's see what you come up with.
Right. So last two few questions. I would like to go back into your life. Like, how difficult was it to come out with your sexual identity? And the second question is, what advice would you give to the LGBTQ community, like regarding, you know, coming out to the community or their own family? Even today, it's difficult. It's it's yeah. opening up slowly, but then still there are kind of barriers and you have all these religious things associated. Yes. So how would yes. you deal with that?
Well, I realized that I was gay when I was about 14. So this was in about 1968. Now, in Australia. Now, there was no sex education, there was no internet, there was no information, there was nothing. I mean, it was in Australia at the time, it was illegal. It was a psychiatric disorder. No. I looked up the encyclopedia, and as a 14, I mean, you know, 14, it's hard being 14 anyway, let alone discovering that you're criminal and you are a psychiatric patient, let alone sin and immoral and all of that. I came out very slowly and very selectively. I mean, I sort of intuitively knew that this was not a good idea to spread this around, to keep it quiet. I never ended up telling my mother, for example. I mean, my father died when I was 3, so clearly that was too early. I never told her because she would have had trouble with that. She came from a different era. Professionally, I never came out. I never said that I was gay professionally. I mean, when I was on television, for example, people would write in, I've got a gay son, blah, blah. I never mentioned anything because I felt that it would compromise. Now, I got a lot of criticism from other people in the LGBTI, blah, blah, blah community about that, because I should have come out. I should have come out. My advice is you come out at the rate that you are comfortable with, and don't let anyone push you around or tell you that you should do it faster. Now, I don't know the situation in India, but I can imagine it's not easy. So my advice is you come out at the rate that you are. Now, my advice to the broader LGBTI, blah, 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 I forget all the letters, and each week there's a new letter, I can't keep up with them, is be a little bit more understanding to members of the community, and don't enforce this kind of rule that you have to do it this way. You know, we're on about liberation and support and freedom. So allow people to choose their own journey, and don't, you know, I mean, I once heard this expression, the oppressed are the worst oppressors. And I think it's very true. So I, you know, do it at your own rate, and don't push or pressure people to do it, you know, any way that they're not comfortable with.
And that was very good advice, Peter. So finally, before wrapping the show up, I would like to say, where can we find your book, if I were you? And what are the links, other links that people can search for?
Well, it's only available in printed copy here in Australia so far. I mean, it's just been released. You can buy it online. And I think that probably the only, I think probably the easiest for people in India or other countries outside of Australia would be through Amazon. So if you just go to Amazon in the book section, If I Were You, A Psychologist Puts Himself on the Couch by Peter Quarry, you should be able to find it and order it. And I do hope that you you enjoy it.
Okay, thank you so much, Peter, for being on Global Conversation with me today, and have a wonderful week and all the best for your future.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure speaking with you, and all the best to you too.
Thank you.